in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We gather here once a week in the studios of KHOI-FM Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa, right in the middle of it all. Yes, we are. And, well, we talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions, and whatever
no
else.
Shortage of opinions
no
here.
Shortage. No. Of, we get around to just about everything here, and we do get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donald on Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for our friend Marcus.
So, thank you for joining us today around our kitchen table. We had a bit of a thunderstorm. We haven't had a rain here in Central Iowa in a while.
It's soggy out there.
Oh, that's kind of new. We haven't had soggy. Oh, that's good.
Don't hang your laundry out today.
Well, actually, if you hang your laundry out, then it will rain. But, yeah, we were in for some rain. We're in for some rain.
That happened?
We're
okay.
in for some rain. But that's good. We need some rain. Garden's kind of dry. It is. So, everybody talks about how the weather's changing, the bugs are different, the birds are flying backwards. Everything is different here in this climate changey sort of thing. But I noticed, and other people say this is not true, but I tried to find elderberries this year. I have three major patches in different areas. Every time I went to a patch, the Japanese beetles. They were there just laughing at me. They had eaten all of the elderberries. So I thought, well, how am I going to make jelly with elderberries if I don't have any?
You're not going to. You know what you're going to make? Japanese beetle jam.
Oh. Now, see, we could.
High in protein. I'll betcha.
We could start a trend, Donna.
Okay.
I like
okay.
this.
Okay. All right.
Stay tuned, folks. No, really. Really, truly. I didn't make Japanese beetle jam. I had, I came upon.
But let's put a little insert here. Lana is famous for her annual production of crabapple elderberry.
Right. People look forward to it. They're already asking for your crabby elderberry jelly. And I think the crabby elderberry is a great way to start your day, I tell people. That's good. But I didn't have elderberries. But a friend gave me a couple big chunks of aronia berries, and I know.
Oh, aronia. Let's make our aronia. I don't like aronia
now,
berries.
See,
yeah,
you're just
let's
like,
make
you're,
some
Donna?
Aronia berry jokes. Oh, boy. They're good for you, I hear.
Huh?
Full of antioxidants. Huh? They're a pretty color, but they don't taste very good, Lana.
Well, see? Now, see, Donna, you're just like a little kid. You got to try new things sometimes.
Okay.
Actually, so I figured since crab apple is added to this recipe, and it's about half and half. So, you know, we got the crabapple really kicking rear end there.
I suppose the sugar's going to fix everything.
And it's going to help.
Okay,
a little sugar, a little squirt of lemon juice. So, I brought some in, Don. Try my crabby aronia berry.
I can relate to crabby aronia.
I thought you could.
Okay, let's see.
I thought you could.
You win.
See?
Whoa.
So, this year we have crabby aronia berry, although, you know.
All right. It does have a slight, on the end of the aftertaste, you do hit that aronia. But it's good. It's good. It works with, I guess, it's not equal. It must be more crabapple than aronia.
Well, it's about half and half.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it makes a lovely color. You got to give it that.
Yeah. And so people.
Plus, it's good for you.
It is good for you. So not only can you be crabby at breakfast, you can have some good for you aronia berry. I've been making other kinds of jelly, too. So it's the season for jelly, and you bring in this pail of stuff and then start this alchemy. It's kind of fun.
It's never a dull moment with Lana, so, okay.
So here's to Japanese beetles, and I don't know, maybe I'll get around to that beetle jelly. I don't know. Here we go. All right. Well, you know, it's good to take a look at the world around us. Let's consider the Iowa landscape, how we impact it, how we change it. Well, can we fix it? We all know in one way or another.
Well, we're always tinkering anyway.
We affect.
Very far from its natural state of prairies and potholes and tall grass, and yeah. So
and what is that going on? Well, today, joining us today at our kitchen table is Omar de Cook Mercado, and he is the project coordinator concentrating on prairies and how to make things better. He's a project coordinator at Iowa State University in the Natural Resources and Ecology Management Department. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
We also got to say that Omar is our friend, and at some point we're going to talk about some other kinds of recipes. He's a pretty inventive cooker himself.
So stick around for all sorts of stuff. So, Omar, what do you do?
For work or just for fun?
Well, I talked about...
That's a pretty open-ended question, Lana.
My opening statement here.
Or it can be the same thing, right?
Yeah. How do we impact the land around us? And what's with this prairie stuff?
So I'm the project coordinator for a project at Iowa State called STRIPS, which stands for the Science-Based Trials of Row Crops Integrated with Prairie Strips. So it's kind of a long acronym, but
science-based. Say that again.
Science-based trials of row crops integrated with prairie strips.
Somebody worked hard on that.
Prairie strips. But you can't say that 10 times, right?
Probably not very fast.
Okay.
Prairie strips. So what do you know?
Go ahead.
No. So what do you do with prairie strips?
So I'm kind of like the professional cat herder for prairie strips. It's a large group of scientists and institutional partners. So we've been doing research for about 13 years. We started in 2007, and now we have about 66 different cooperators that have prairie strips on their farms in six different states.
How big is it, prairie strip? I'm thinking, like, is it 6 inches wide, 6 feet wide? How big is a prairie strip?
So our findings show that if you replace 10% of a row crop field, you'll get the benefits of a prairie strip, which is a 95% reduction in soil loss, and also an 85% reduction in nitrogen surface runoff, which is huge. But in general,
does that mean you can save money by not buying as much nitrogen, and that covers the loss of the 10% of ground that you would have planted in some moneymaker?
So
it comes out in the wash, so to speak?
Somewhat. It just kind of depends on the individual farm. But in general, mm-hmm. prairie would do really well in a low-yielding area or an area that's not so productive. Uh-huh. So if a farmer is still continuing to farm a low-yielding area, they're investing money in inputs like nitrogen fertilizers and pesticides if they're using them. So when they plant it in the prairie, that becomes both more profitable for the farmer and for conservation because you're introducing diversity and you get the benefits of pollinator habitat.
Wait, so once you put a strip in, since it's prairie, it's perennial. You don't have to mess with that land.
Right. So it's a prairie, but that doesn't mean that there isn't any management. It's not no management. It's low management.
Mm-hmm.
So the first couple of years of prairie establishment is a little bit more involved. You basically mow it like you would a grassed waterway. And what that does is it discourages the annual weeds mm-hmm. from coming up and allows the prairie to establish roots. So in about, you could do it, you could stop mowing in the second year or third year, and by then the prairie will have been well established and outcompete the annual weeds when it comes up in the spring. So that's why we say it's low management. But you were asking what the size of a prairie strip is. So in general, we want them to be at least 30 feet wide.
Oh, okay.
And so what a prairie strip is, it's literally a strip of prairie in the middle of a row crop field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and since...
Or at the toe slope of a
Here row we crop are field. At Iowa, so we can often find land that is flat and geometric. So thinking of a strip through part of it or... In a place of it's pretty good, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, very good.
So we have to kind of imagine the context too of what Iowa used to be. So, about 10,000 to 11,000 years ago, Iowa was part of a massive prairie network that was about 170 million acres. So that's kind of a huge number to wrap your head around.
It's a lot.
So if you think about looking at a map of North America, that would
Are we talking about the? This is the tall grass prairie?
Well, just prairie in general.
All,
so that's short grass and
short
tall grass.
And tall. Okay.
So Iowa's mostly tall grass prairie and then oak savanna, so it's about 85% mm-hmm. prairie. But this massive prairie mixture was all the way from Canada down to Texas, spreading from Indiana to Colorado to the Rockies. And then down in Texas, that connected to the southeast pine savannas that basically ran all the way up the Appalachia.
Oh, okay.
And then if you think about Mexico and South America, those are also, you know, large. Those used to be large wildlife
grasslands,
corridors.
Grasslands, yeah. Basically, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it was absolutely massive and really hard to wrap your head around on how massive it was. So when we think about, you know, integrating prairie on the Iowan landscape, which was, like I mentioned, Iowa was 85% prairie at one time, which now that 85% is farming.
Right, right.
Mostly farming.
Uh-huh.
So that's about 26 million acres of farmland that was once prairie.
Mm-hmm.
So prairie does really well here, obviously. So mm-hmm. when we install prairie in a farm field, it's not hard to establish because it's literally been adapting to the landscape for the last 10,000 years. So it's very well adapted and does really well. So that's, I guess it's one way of bringing back prairie to, you know, bringing the functionality of prairie to the economic needs of farming.
And you say if you bring back just 10% of the prairie into your farming system, you can save how much soil erosion?
95%.
That's pretty generous of that prairie, don't you think?
That's pretty,
you give it 10% and it saves you 95%. I'd put my money on that.
Yeah, so that
sounds like a good investment to me.
Right, that's something that we call disproportionate benefits.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Stock market doesn't work like that.
And you said this has been going on for 13 years?
The initial experiment started in 2007.
That's great. Yep. That's great. And now I mentioned my run-in with Japanese beetles, and we're watching major awful weather events, and it seems that people are finally wanting to address climate and our land and sustainability on a bigger scale. You mentioned a project called Sea Change. Can you mention, just talk a few words about Sea Change?
Is that S-E-E-S-E-A? Nope,
so
the letter C?
It's yet another acronym, like STRIPS. But,
oh.
It's the letter C, hyphen, C. And then change. And it stands for the Consortium for Cultivating Human and Regenerative Enterprises. And we're hoping that...
Lovely. Lovely academic speak. Boy. Say that one more time.
The
Consortium...
For Cultivating Human and Regenerative Enterprises.
Great.
So the consortium, we're hoping, is going to change into a center.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be the center for... scientists that are conducting research on something that we're overarchingly calling regenerative
mm-hmm.
and enterprises. So one example of that would be a prairie strip.
Mm-hmm.
So we're integrating perennials into a mostly annual landscape. So we have year-round cover and, you know, focusing on things like integrating cover crops into livestock farming. So you could have a corn and soybean rotation with 60-inch rows and a cover crop. You might, you know, silage corn. You could chop that corn, feed it to your neighbor, your livestock, and maybe the neighbor. You might have a partnership with the neighbor that grazes the winter crop, and kind of reintroducing some diversity on the landscape in the form of small grains like oats and rye
and animals.
Yeah, and just generally focusing research on. Getting greater functionality out of the working landscape.
This seems an interesting way for an institution like a land-grant university to look at agriculture mindfully. It's like you're backing up and looking at the whole picture as opposed just to, feeding the world and just producing. There's we seem to have... want to get back to caretaking and looking at conservation and thinking of the
long term. I have to be a little curmudgeonly here, because when I was a child growing up in this landscape, we had animals on the farm. We had a lot more diversity. So, you know, if one wanted to be a little bit
curmudgeonly,
grumpy, yes, we could say, oh, so now we have to do research to get back to where we were 60 years ago. I mean, I know that's not exactly true, because people always like accuse organic farmers of farming the way they did 100 years ago. Well, actually, that's not true. There's a lot of research that has gone into current thinking. Like 50 years ago, we didn't even know about the microbiome of the soil.
Right.
We're still learning about that.
Yeah, and microbiology is a relatively new science.
Yeah. I mean, we are not actually going, it may look like your grandfather's farm, but it's a really different understanding of.
Now, there's a lot of opportunities to combine what we know now mm-hmm. with the way things used to be. The land historically was multifunctional, mm-hmm. and right now we've really oversimplified that system. And
took all the fences out. Now we got to put some of those fences back in.
Right. And if we look at any natural ecosystem, there's a lot of diversity. And that diversity is what allows the system to work without outside inputs.
Well, Wes Jackson at the Land Institute, who's been looking at these things for a long time about growing, he says in nature, there is always diversity. There is always perennial polyculture. Nothing grows in monocultures. To get back this a natural systems agriculture that is more resilient to some of these weather changes that we're having, we will need more polyculture.
And a polyculture is like, you know, it's the opposite of putting your eggs in one basket.
Exactly. Exactly.
Ah, a good farm analogy.
Exactly.
Has it been a challenge to convince landholders, farmers, to try these new things, or are we? What's your experience?
Well, to give a little background into how I work with farmers and kind of my public servant career prior to working at Iowa State. I was working with the USDA, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and that's an agency that provides cost share for conservation. So a farmer could come in, say they want to put in a grass waterway, which is, you know, just grass on a slope at the confluence of two slopes. So like in between two hills.
To reduce erosion.
To reduce erosion, yeah. Or to move water off the field. They could get cost share to rent a dozer and, you know, grade that out into a slope or whatever. That's so I would go out into the field and talk with farmers and say, you could really use a grass waterway here. And more often than not, that's a conversation that is you hopefully let the farmer lead for you. And kind of my experience has been that they're people just like you and I. They're not farmers. They're, you know, they might be a wife or a brother or a sister, or, you know, they have the same outlook that most people do. So you want to talk to them like they're a person trying to solve a problem or not trying to solve a problem. It just depends on the context. So my experience is that if you can talk to a farmer in such a way to understand their management and why they make decisions the way they do, then that really opens up a lot of opportunities to talk about how to improve that management, be it either spending less time in the field or spending less money on fertilizers or reducing the amount of passes with pesticides, not getting up as early. Having less soil loss. So, you know, I think the word conservation needs to be updated somehow. I don't have a good solution for that. It's, you know, we were talking about the landscape being very simple, and we're trying to introduce some complexity. That's not really conservation. That's, you know, being mindful that we can.
Well, the landscape is in fact not as simple as we thought it was.
No, we
human beings are the simpletons here sometimes. You know,
right.
There's a lot going on that we still.
And I just the. you need to be able to embrace complexity if you want to have a system that is complex.
And as we learn more things, we can actually maybe make some good decisions here. This is KHOI 89.1. This is the Donalana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking to Omar DeCook Mercado about prairie strips. Yes, we are. That was a little tune by Alice McGarry and a bunch of other good people. Some local Iowa-grown music. That tune was called 5 Miles Out of Town. So you talk prairie to people. Omar, how do you talk about prairies? They seem so out, romantically out there, and maybe even, I don't know, the frontier days. Why do we need them back? How do you talk about prairies?
That's a good question.
Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned the frontier, because, uh-huh. You know, when the Easterners came, and they were all Europeans.
Broke up the prairie.
That they were used to forested lands. So when they overlooked this massive sea of grass, they, I think, probably initially got pretty scared and retreated back into the woods and came up with a game plan, which was conquer the grassland. At least that's the way I perceive it. But So you know, when you talk to, you know, people about prairie, it's disappeared in probably about 100 years in a really short time frame. So to think about, you know, a mass exodus.
Yeah. You make it sound like it just vanished.
Well, I mean, that's essentially what happened. It literally just poof, it was gone. Mm-hmm. Kind of like mowing the grass, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it got plowed under. So when we, you know, farming is integral to the Iowan culture. So when you talk about prairies, I feel like you can connect with people talking about it as part of their integral Iowan culture. So it's, you know, it's the rainforest of the Midwest. It's very diverse. It has the same functions as a rainforest. Arguably, it's more diverse, according to some scientists. But so you can talk about prairie in a lot of different lenses, you know, lenses of science with the soil reduction and soil erosion and retention of nutrients. You can talk to it in a lens of wonder. Of, you know, the complexity. Prairie doesn't look like a whole lot when you're looking at it from the road, but when you get inside of it and you look down, it's really a beautiful world, and it's a lot of different flowering plants of all different shapes and colors and different kinds of grasses that have all different shapes and colors.
Lots of bugs, lots of birds, lots of critters.
You used a term called agricultural term, a sub-profitable land. How does that relate to prairies?
So like we were mentioning, a farmer might have low yielding acres, or another jargon term is red acres, because farmers might have precision ag yield monitors, and on those printouts are the red acres that they're not making money on.
So what does that mean? Where the soil quality might be not as good, or it's on an incline, or what makes those?
So that's it's all about perception, right? So it's not good for, you know, corn and soybean.
Ah.
But it is profitable for prairie. Yeah, but I'm talking too loud into the mic. I'm getting the fingers down.
No, I think I was banging you on the table. That's
just me getting excited about prairie.
We are excited about prairie.
So that's what I mean about sub-profitable. Sub-profitable in the sense of corn and soybean production.
Yeah, we have to learn how to value things a little bit differently. The corn and soybean, we kind of this analogy again. We put all our eggs into this basket of commodity crops. And I don't know. There's other ways to...
It hasn't been working out so well in the last few years.
There's other ways to maybe do things here.
We're on the verge of another 1980s farming crisis.
Yeah.
Economically.
Goodness.
So
goodness.
The bottom line...
So, the bottom line is that we have an opportunity to face this challenge with perennial crops like prairie. So... Michigan State actually just released an interesting study that showed that about a quarter of the Midwest landscape could be perennialized, and that quarter is, again,
sub-profitable. Okay, when you're talking perennialized,
sub-profitable.
Not going to harvest much from a prairie. What else is
there? Well, that's arguable, too. That is something that we want to look at. You know, prairie is not just prairie. It could be biomass. It could be hay. It could be bedding. You could even go as far as to say that we could do pharmaceutical research on prairie. There's a lot of medicinal value in some of these plants, but the complexity of that is how do you harvest and process, and where's the market, and what's the infrastructure for that? So those are things that we can think and talk about and do research on that we don't have infrastructure for right now.
That's a major problem in any agricultural thing. Like, we are all set up for the farmer. He can grow his corn, he can grow his soybeans, and he goes right to his co-op. It gets in the co-op, onto the trains, and off it goes.
Right, and we have it's a really efficient system in that.
Right,
in that,
but if he wants to grow oats, that's a whole other problem. Or if he wants to grow some other small grains, we have lost our ability to actually, where do you take it once you grow it?
Right.
It's one thing to grow it, then you got to store it, you got to sell it, you got to move it.
Yeah, that's part of the things that we need to look at.
Yeah, so by concentrating on corn and soy, we've kind of cornered ourselves here.
Well, it's like you think about any other system, like we were talking before, is if you oversimplify it, you start losing the functionality. But back to that quarter of the Midwest that we could perennialize. It's not just prairie. I mean, we could do a large network of prairie that, you know, like, and use those as corridors for grazing livestock to cover crop fields, for example. But it's not just prairie.
Are we going to bring back the buffalo?
I would love to bring back the buffalo.
That'd be great.
I like a good buffalo. There is a market for that.
But there's trees too. You said oak savanna.
Trees. We can do oak savannas they function as an oak savanna, but they're also functioning as a place to grow fruit and nuts and graze livestock.
There's grass growing under those trees
and,
or some,
you know,
kind of.
Iowa could have an amazing timber market if we really, you know, focused our effort on developing that.
We can do lots more than just one or two things. Let's broaden our horizons a little bit. You kind of alluded to the joy of prairies, the beauty of prairies, and you had a kind of doing a project that integrates art and prairies. Talk about that.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for this project. That's one fun thing about my job. I get to figure out creative ways to communicate science, and one of those. This isn't directly related to the Prairie Strips project, but. I, on a professional note, but I am doing it with a designer from Iowa State. His name is Austin Stewart. He's a co-owner of the new community center called Reliable Street, and him and his wife run Lockwood Cafe, and I'm just putting in a little plug for them because they're about to be open and they're training
staff.
Oh,
yay. We've had Sharon on the show a couple of times. We have been waiting and waiting and waiting, and I'm glad they're going to be open soon.
You know, I've provided emotional support in the form of six-packs several times. So
very good. Very good.
So the project that Austin and I are doing is funded by the Iowa DNR, the Iowa Arts Council, and then the College of Design at Iowa State. And the theme of it is that celebrating 100 years of Iowa State parks. So they're commemorating that with giving 20 artists and working in 20 parks. And each artist is responsible for, you know, interpreting this commemoration in their own way. So technically, it's 21 artists in 20 parks because Austin and I are a duo. So, but they've already published everything.
So what park are you doing?
So we're in Brushy Creek State Park, which is about an hour north of here.
Oh, good. What are some of the projects in the works, or are they done? Or
so we had a a full month of field data collection. So what we did is we created three sensor arrays. So these sensors, they collected red, green, and blue wavelength of light, velocity of wind, temperature, gyroscopic movement. So that's like movement in 3D space. And I can't remember if we did moisture or not, but we had three sensor arrays, and one of them was a wind vane in the middle of a prairie, which was made out of white canvas umbrellas. And we hooked that up to a bike wheel on a post and just threw that up in the middle of the prairie so when people would round the park corner and see this white, majestic-looking, it was really something to see when you turned the corner. It was like, what is that? And it gave me a sense of wonder, but I'm biased because we designed it and put it up there. But so that we collected field data from that wind vane, and then one in a tree, and then one in the soil.
So is this state park just a big prairie patch, or what?
It's got woods and lakes and campgrounds, and yeah, it's a really beautiful park. It was nice to be able to have an excuse to, I got to do work for the Iowa DNR and the Iowa Arts Council. And
oh, shit, I got to go to the park to do
my work. I'm a paid artist going to the park.
Well, you had the opportunity to make the wind visible for people, and that's a very lovely thing.
So that's just the beginning of this whole crazy thing. So,
okay, lots of other crazy things to come, huh?
So we're using this data, and we're running it through some machines that we're building. So people will be able to visualize this invisible world that's around us functioning all the time.
Oh, you mean you're going to come up with some graphs?
Nope.
What? Oh, good. Well, then what?
So
a full-length feature film, perhaps.
So it's a 10-minute piece of visualization that's accompanied with audio. And then that data that we got from our sensor arrays is going to be running footage that we took at the park and then other things, and they'll be overlaid and mixed with analog video mixers that we can control with voltage and audio that we can control with voltage. So this data, we can subjectively design how we want to manipulate, say, the luminance factor, or like the highlights or the shadows or the colors of the video. And then the audio, we can manipulate, oscillators that vibrate at different frequencies.
Does this, make the bird sounds louder or something? I mean, is it all really abstract?
It's abstract. It's an abstract interpretation of the environment, which is what all art is, essentially.
How abstract are we talking here? Am I going to recognize this as a state park when I look at it?
Most likely not.
Oh.
Yeah. But the exhibit will be traveling in three different art exhibits. Unfortunately, I can't remember exactly which ones. I think they're still going to be formally announced later. But in 2020, this will be an active exhibit. Mm-hmm. And
so there's other artists working in other locations.
Right. Yep. Okay. So there's
doing different things.
Right. So there's some artists painting, and other artists are taking sequential photographs and making an experience walking through the park. And there's another fella that's flying a kite with a hurdy-gurdy and making interesting sounds. And I think it's going to be a really great exhibit. I've only had a chance to look at a few other projects over Instagram. But it looks like it's going to be a great exhibit. I'm excited to see it.
Oh, lovely. And what is this going to be? Do you know what it's going to be called? Or
I'm not sure. I'm guessing like the 100-year commemoration or something like that.
Okay, all right.
And where is one going to see the exhibits?
They'll be in three different exhibits in 2020, and I think they still have to be announced. But
so stay tuned. We could maybe even announce them here on the Donalana Kitchen. But something to look forward to, a celebration of our Iowa parks. Oh, very good. Very good.
So just to kind of put a nail in the coffin with what it is, project, because I never answered you fully, because it's a project that rambles on. What I want it to be is a new human experience that no one has experienced.
That's good.
Interpretation of nature. These are all cliches when you think about art, right? That's mm-hmm. You look at a painting and that's new to you, and it can make you feel a certain way, or listen to music and that's new to you and it can make you feel a certain way.
I don't know, Omar. I'm having enough trouble with the current experiences, let alone adding on another layer.
The more we think, I think the better. I have no idea whether this is part of your upcoming presentation or upcoming work, but I found, like we mentioned, I've known Omar for quite a while, and a couple months ago, I found him in the middle of the best firefly display at Ada Hayden, and he was recording it, videoing it, and just the fact that he was out there, you could barely see him, it was dark, and here he is, taking pictures of all of this. And somehow when it gets onto a screen, I mean, I was enjoying the fireflies just as is, but on a screen, they do become a work of art. And knowing Omar, he'll turn it into
like
something.
When you put a frame around some small piece of reality, you tend to notice it with more detail.
Oh, that's very good. That's very good. Any other fun stuff coming up?
For prairies or arts in the park or
anything that you want to talk about, your prairies?
I'm doing all kinds of stuff all the time, so it's hard to.
Oh, good.
It's hard to have
pick one.
I don't know. I like having 24 hours in a day because it gives you an excuse to stop. But sometimes it can be frustrating. So one thing I've been up to lately, as you mentioned, is culinary alchemy.
Oh, that's very good. Oh, yes. See, besides going out and doing prairie things, Omar is a real fun person to be around in the kitchen. We're going to take a little station break here. This is KHOI 89.1. This is the Donalana Kitchen. And in a little song, this is an original song by Alice McGarry. And it's about food, so we just have to play it. We'll come back and talk more to Omar.
If you ain't no cup of coffee, this is a song about food. Remember my first glass of whiskey, how scared I was when I first felt you hit me, kicking my tongue and winking my whole bubbles, old tight to my chair. Peaches in the summertime, apples in the fall. If I can have the one I love, I don't want none at all. Remember
Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was a tune called Bread and Butter, part of a tune called Bread and Butter by Alice McGarry. We're talking about food as usual here, but we're also talking about prairies and other
landscape
stuff and art. And we're here with Omar de Cook Mercado. And not only does he do stuff out in prairies and talks to farmers and works with regeneration and sustainability, but he's an interesting guy to be around in the kitchen. Omar, what's cooking in your kitchen these days?
So,
in your alchemical kitchen.
Yeah, the kitchen of wizardry. Yeah, I'm a avid fermenter. So not the beers and ciders and wines and stuff. I kind of dabble in that, you know, here and there.
All right. But I'm dying to know what this coffee kombucha stuff is that you talk about. Come on.
So I'm kind of obsessed with waste streams and how to utilize waste streams. So I like coffee. So I drink coffee in the mornings. And what I do with my coffee is I save the grounds and make coffee kombucha.
Just throw them in the garden?
Well, hear me out on the coffee kombucha.
Okay.
It will eventually get to the garden, but there's multiple steps in
between. Oh, you can use it a few times before it goes to the garden.
So again, traditionally people would just throw out coffee grounds and throw them in the garden or compost them with worms, but I'm going to feed it to my SCOBY. And so the way I do it is I drink coffee in the morning, and then when I'm done with my grounds, I save it in a quart jar and I leave it in the fridge. And every morning I make my coffee, put it in the quart jar, put it in the fridge. And then until when the quart jar is packed and it's full of coffee, that's when I boil a little bit of sugar. So it's about I wrote the recipe down here for you guys. It's about 250 grams of sugar to 2 liters of water. So I don't my fermenting approach is I don't do a lot of prep work. I don't want to do a lot of prep work. That's kind of my rule of thumb with fermenting. It needs to be things of high volume and easy to process, and that's the art of fermenting. It should just be quick
and very good.
Coffee
grounds and sugar, and I just boil a little bit of water to make syrup instead of boiling the whole water column or 2 liters of water, because that takes a lot of energy and time, and you got to let it cool and all that stuff. So I boil that syrup, and then I throw it on top of the coffee grounds, and then I fill that 2 liter jug up with water, and I infuse it for 24 hours in the fridge, and then I strain that in the morning, and I just let it sit on my counter, get to room temperature. You can throw your SCOBY in there cold, but I mean, they're, you know, microorganisms are like us. They want to be comfortable.
So you're straining it, and at that point you're getting rid. So you basically do a second infusion of the coffee.
Right.
And then you throw it
into
the compost.
And you can use fresh coffee, but why use fresh coffee if you can use the spent coffee? And it's kombucha, so it's not going to taste like coffee. It's going to get a different
Taste like coffee at all.
Well, it does taste like coffee, but not the coffee that you made that morning. So if you can get a nice carbonation, it really kind of tastes like nitro coffee. And nitro coffee is kind of expensive. So if you can make it out of a waste stream, then why not?
Wait, okay. So you end up with a 2 liter jar with a SCOBY in it, and then it's just like a regular kombucha. You have to let it sit a while at room temperature, basically.
And carbonate. Yep.
Sort of how long?
It really depends on temperature.
Right.
But if it's at room temperature, it'll be about a week or 2 weeks if your SCOBY is adapted to the coffee. So what I do is I experiment a lot with kombucha, so I don't use the same SCOBY for each individual experiment. I do it in 2 liter batches. So right now I have a goldenrod SCOBY that's making goldenrod kombucha, but I keep a SCOBY hotel is what I call it.
This is literal, right? Goldenrod.
Yep.
So you're picking goldenrod right now while it's.
Yep, and you make tea out of it, and then just like you would for any other thing, and kombucha.
So you just steep it and strain it.
Yep.
Yep. Okay.
Because
yep.
if you don't take it out, the yeast might outcompete the yeast in the SCOBY, theoretically. Mm-hmm. I've never experimented with that, mm-hmm. but. So I have my SCOBY hotel that's just in sugar water. That's all I have. I just feed it sugar and water. And then when I want to make an experiment, I take off the top layer and throw it in a 2-liter jar. So, you know, I've done stuff like rhubarb kombucha and elderberry kombucha and apple kombucha with apple juice.
So when you're doing those fruit kombuchas, are you using a tea base in them?
Mm-mm. No, it's just,
it's just straight fruit,
juice.
Fruit and
yep.
sugar.
Yep, that's diluted.
Whoa, Lana, do you usually put tea in yours, right?
Yeah, I usually start out with tea, but then I usually add a little fruit juice later. But Omar has broken through the barrier, and I'm going to try some of this other stuff too, because especially the coffee kombucha. Now, see, it's a live thing. And I remember the first time I tasted it, I thought, well, it could use some work. But you've got it down now.
Yep. So, yeah, all of the things I have going in my kitchen right now are basically water, some sort of sugar source, yeast if I want to make alcohol, and then, like, savory ingredients. So my latest pride and joy is a wild yeast that I cultivated from a variety of locally foraged items that are currently in bloom or fruiting.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it
which
the high.
Which means you didn't add any commercial yeast.
Nope.
Oh, goody.
So this is, I call it the high summer yeast extraction. It's goldenrod, garden raspberry, wild plum, autumn olives, high bush cranberry.
It's an autumn olive.
Wild grape, elderberry, and wild hops. Autumn olive is technically considered an invasive.
It's a tree bush thing.
Yeah, tree shrub.
Yeah.
But I don't like that term, invasive. For me, it's either desirable or not desirable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can use autumn olive if you want, and it grows like weed.
Yeah, it's true. All of this good stuff.
So with that wild yeast, what I do is inoculate things that have a lot of sugar in them, and I use that yeast to make alcohol. So the latest experiment is... Chaga Rishi beer.
Oh, for goodness sake. Do tell, Omar.
What so, makes it a beer?
I mean, that whole gradient of beer to sodas and all that sort of stuff. Like,
does it mean there's a grain in it? Does that make it a beer?
So this is you know, like a true beer fermenter would not be happy with the way I make beer or call it beer because I use... easy sugar sources, but you could use malted grains if you wanted to, but I'm trying to do it from, you know, local ingredients. Again, like, it's the waste stream thing.
So what's your easy sugar source then?
For Iowa, it'd be maple and birch syrup, but you could do honey too, but mm-hmm. I don't really like the taste of mead all that much. So on a personal level, and you know, mead's pretty straightforward to make, but you can get a lot of complexity with syrups and there's all different kinds of sugar sources that you could use. You could use like a fruit molasses syrup.
Sorghum, probably.
You could use sorghum. The cool thing about having your cultivated yeast is that you can train them to like certain solutions. So, like, my coffee kombucha took about, you know, a little bit over 2 months to get acclimated to the acidity of coffee. But now it's just like this...
okay, but when you say
cracking.
Train them, does that mean you just keep using the same SCOBY and making new batches until it does better and better in the medium that you've put it in?
So microbes,
that's your idea of training?
Yeah, microbes are really adaptive. They need to adapt mm-hmm. to their environment. And so over time, they'll get really efficient at
it. So in your SCOBY hotel, you have little spaces for each, like you've got your coffee SCOBY, you've got, no.
No, I just have a... you know, a SCOBY that's just sugar and water, and then all of my other experiments are in 2-liter jars. So I take this.
So, but like once the coffee SCOBY gets adapted, you maintain it only in coffee, right?
Right, right.
Because you want it to hold the adaptation.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. So that means if I want to make a coffee kombucha, I would have to come and because you're multiplying the Scoobies, right? So you'll right. have one to give me, right? So
I could give you one, yeah. But but you can make your own really easily. So anyway, that beer, I guess I call it a beer because it's got yeast and sugar source and
must
water
be brown,
and savory
right?
yeah. ingredients.
Back up and tell us the ingredients in this.
Chaga mushrooms.
So it's chaga mushrooms that Megan and I got in the Northwoods. Huh? And then reishi mushrooms that we grew at home. And then there's usually you want some sort of acid source, so I like using lemon juice, which is easy to find.
I guess you could use aronia berries.
It probably could. I don't know. As long as it's acidic and you want to outcompete other organisms. Mm-hmm. And then it's got hops in it as a bittering agent.
Ah.
And then birch syrup and maple syrup.
Oh, see?
And
see?
So that's one
so
batch.
So the hops is kind of the beerish thing.
Right.
And okay, then, fair.
So that's the one version of it, and the other version is just chaga with regular sugar, because I wanted to see the nuance of the sugar source.
Do you have a little instrument where you can check the alcoholic level?
I do, but I never use it.
So you just taste it and see if you get a buzz or not, right?
Yeah, for me, it's all personal consumption, so
we are not selling this, folks. Yeah. Just so you know, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say the longer you let it ferment, the more alcoholic it will become with the sugars, and the sugars will change to alcohol. So it sounds interesting.
And the thing with wild yeast is there's a little bit more of variability with wild yeast because most of them
are a lot of variability.
They're not adapted to high alcohol percentages. So mm-hmm. in general, they might at best be 6%. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it goes up above 6%, they start dying. Mm-hmm. And you can tell when the ferment stops being as active because it's not bubbling. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. then I do a second bottling and put a little sugar in that. And whatever yeast is left over, maybe they'll be active. But
and you keep tasting. Oh, how good, how good.
Well, I just have to say one thing about wild yeast. For beer makers or other beverage makers, when you buy a commercial yeast and add it, it has been my experience that you ultimately, it ends up tasting. Those commercial yeasts are very strong in flavor and will dominate most of what your home brew is. Whereas if you're using a wild yeast, you're going to get more flavor dominance by the other ingredients that you add. I'm all for wild yeast.
Omar, it sounds like you have a wonderful time in your kitchen. Keep tasting. Keep tasting. We've been talking to Omar, the cook, Mikado. He knows a lot about prairies. He also knows a lot about ferments. All good things. All good things. Yes. We have a few upcoming things. Friday the 13th is coming up, and there
Woo-hoo!
there'll be a micro harvest moon that night, a small harvest moon.
Micro
but Friday the 13th, moon. We'll have to celebrate there. Yes, and farmers markets are going strong. Get your apples, get your pumpkins, get your sweet, get your mushrooms too. Oh, yes, you do. Lots of good things coming up. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. You can find us here on KHOI Tuesday at noon. It's repeated 7 p.m. You can find out more at khoifm.org. You can download, you can stream, you can add us to your device. Find our webpage there. We've got old shows. We've got recipes. There's a picture of us. Everything. Or you can contact us and talk to us. Tell us what's in your kitchen at khoiradio@gmail.com. We had music today by Alice McGarry and Rick Exner from their CD, 5 Miles Out of Town. Lots of good local musicians there. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be going out with a tune called You Gotta Quit Kicking My Dog Around. Yes, and that's a fine tune. And dog owners here around this table. Yes, siree. Good tune. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Cynthia McClure. Eat good food and enjoy life.